is the stuff underneath, and that hasn't been really touched yet. And we're going to try and bring some of it up to the surface and find out if some of you can get a hold of it. I know I did a public appearance alongside Larry Bensky of KPFA, who is currently covering the ContraGate and IranGate hearings for the Pacifica News Network. And Larry was his focus, his speech was on the things that we will be looking for, although not necessarily actually expecting to see or hear during the ContraGate hearings. And one of the things that one of many things that Larry and I agreed on very strongly was that the sleeper issue in the whole ContraGate hearing was the drug issue, and that if this came up and was actually addressed with any sort of open-mindedness at all, it could quite conceivably blow the Reagan administration right out of the water. The Just Say No, Nancy sitting on Mr. T's lap to lecture Emmanuel Lewis about the evils of drug abuse, Reagan administration, right smack dab out of the harbor. And as we had feared, so far it has been virtually a non-issue. Well, we intend to do what we can, Dave and I, in our small way to rectify that situation tonight and perhaps spawn a few angry letters to the committee, to the newspapers, and a few angry phone calls to some of the other talk shows. So
we've broken down the Iran-ContraGate material into three basic categories. Now, one of the things that should be understood is that all three of these categories, in a sense, bleed off heavily into one another. They're very closely interrelated, so much so that, in fact, at least to a certain extent, the distinction among them is academic, at least up to a point. We're doing this so that people can break down the wealth of information that's coming in into a... I don't even know if this is a word, a conceptually viable framework so that people can comprehend and file away what's going on. The first part of the program that we're doing this evening is on the drug connections to the Iran-ContraGate scandal. Part 2, Radio Free America number 30, is going to be on the evening of Wednesday, June 24th, from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m., and there we're going to deal with a subject which intersects very closely with the drug connections, namely the terror connections. In fact, the many terrorist connections to the Iran-Contra scandal not only intersect with, but to a certain extent grow right out of the drug connections we're going to be talking about this evening. Let me explain right off the bat, as you will discover during the course of this three-part series, that certain articles, certain elements of information will be repeated in other broadcasts. There will be a considerable degree of overlap, particularly between the first two programs, although obviously the cover-up itself. Part 3 will be on the evening of Sunday, July 12th, from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. That will be the cover-up. The items being covered up, as Nip indicated, one of the truly explosive aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal is the drug connections, the use of large-scale narcotics trafficking to finance the arms purchases. This is a long-standing tactic of the U.S. covert intelligence establishment, as we looked at rather exhaustive length in our five-part series, Radio Free America shows 24 through 28. Number 29 will proceed directly from those broadcasts, and number 30, in a sense, will proceed directly from number 29 and will also refer back heavily to our Drugs and Intelligence series. Number 31, on Sunday, July 12th, will represent the cover-up of the two explosive issues here, the drug connections and the terror connections. As Nip indicated, the Reagan administration has inveighed heavily against drug abuse. Certainly, we would agree with his basic outlook, however, his tactics and other means of addressing the problem, including trafficking and the very drugs that he is condemning, we disagree with fundamentally. The Reagan administration has also obviously banged the drum loudly and frequently against the terrorist menace. What we're going to be looking at in our next program is how this arms for drugs traffic that figures at the core of Iran-ContraGate has been used to finance world terrorism. We're going to be taking a look at the Triple Wilson team at considerable length. We'll be looking at them some this evening. We're going to take a look at the terror connections next. The cover-up will be, in our opinion, is being affected to a considerable extent to cover up the two great bugaboos of the Reagan administration, terrorism and drug trafficking, both of which Ronald Reagan has laid at the doorstep of the evil empire, the Soviet Union. If the Iran-ContraGate scandal were not to be covered up, and the third part of our program is going to deal with some strong indications that at least to a certain extent it will be, then the Reagan administration would find itself being blamed, and rightfully so, for the two great evils that have laid at the door of our Russian competitor.
Yes, if we had to find a subtitle for this whole mini-series, this three-part series, what springs to my mind are the words of the great Walt Kelly, the wonderful satirist and cartoonist who did Pogo for so many years. And in the height of the McCarthy hearings, one of his Pogo strips ended with the words, "We have met the enemy, and it is us." And in fact, that is exactly what we're talking about, folks. Everything that we have been screaming and yelling about in the finest form of psychotic displacement we have been howling about on the international stage for years. Well, it's us, folks. We've been doing it, and we're doing it now, and we will continue to do it unless a stop is put to it.
Also, the words of Ben Franklin and Poor Richard's Almanac, "Those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones." and indeed, for looking at it in the context of that well-known phrase, we could also term the Radio Free America 29 through 31 tapes the Glass House tapes. Of course, punning on the subject material of a good part of Radio Free America number 23, a book by that exact title, although dealing with a different, although related subject matter.
We're in trouble now, Dave. We've got jargon. We've got in-jokes. I mean, we've been doing this too long.
Well, I think we're going to be repeating the series beginning with after Radio Free America 31. We are going to add some programs to the archive series, but we're going to begin repeating them for the benefit of people that have not been with us since April of 84 when we first began this series. As we repeat them, we're going to begin developing a source index. Each item will be listed by the source, and we're going to put those on a sheet that will be available with each tape from DAVCorp as we begin rebroadcasting them. So, because a lot of people have requested something of that type, in essence, it'll represent a broad subject and source index that will be available for each broadcast, and maybe we can cross-reference it between the various programs as well. But we're, you know, the enterprise has now reached, of course, punning on what was referred to, this whole operation was referred to our enterprise, not the enterprise, is going to proceed to stage two now, and we're going to begin trying to get a few things in print off of these Radio Free America programs, as well as rebroadcasting them for people that have not been with us right from the start.
That's right. Now, speaking of infrastructure, and infrastructure is indeed what we've been talking about here, the infrastructure of Radio Free America is for those of you who like to know what you have coming up ahead of you this evening, and also for those of you who want to perhaps summarize it on the tape covers or something and don't want to have to skip through the whole thing piece by piece. Why don't we run down real quickly what we're going to be covering in the upcoming broadcast, at least in a general sort of way, and let you know what we'll be proceeding with, what we will be proceeding with in the next 4 hours.
What we're going to begin with is something called the Medellin Cartel. That's a cocaine smuggling cartel operating out of Colombia. As we're going to see, it was heavily involved with the Contra supply operation. A good portion of the proceeds from the Iran-Contra scandal have, or the Iran-Contra operation, I should say, have proceeded from cocaine smuggling in partnership with the Medellin cartel. We're going to take a look at that. We're going to take a look at attempts by the U.S. covert team, the secret team, as the Christic Institute people refer to it, to pin that very same drug smuggling on the Sandinistas. We're going to take a look at a sting which was set up by the secret team. It was supposed to sting the Sandinistas. In fact, it appears that it wound up stinging elements of the Contras, and in particular wound up stinging a DEA informant named Adler Barry Seal, who was going to testify perhaps about the Contra-Medellin cartel link. He was assassinated under as yet strange circumstances. We're going to take a look at some of the information he might have been able to reveal, namely the use of cocaine smuggling by the U.S. intelligence establishment to finance the Contra arms purchases. This stands out very... This will be a subject which will look very familiar, should be very familiar to veterans of our previous programs on the intelligence community's involvement in narcotics and arms smuggling, specifically Radio Free America programs number 25, 26, and 27. We're going to take a look at some cases relating to the Medellin-Contra link. We're going to take a look at the Pizza Connection case, a heroin and a cocaine smuggling case out of New York, which may very well dovetail not only with the Medellin cartel, but also with elements of the White House, specifically George Bush and a family, and the former White House Chief of Staff, Donald Regan. We're going to take a look at that. We're going to take a look at a history of the involvement of Brigade 2506 and the anti-Castro Cubans in the drug trafficking and with the secret team that we're talking about. This will overlap to a considerable extent with information provided on Radio Free America shows 26 and 27, also number 24 as well, about the involvement of the U.S. intelligence community in the Southeast Asian drug traffic. We're also going to take a look at something called the Nugenhan Bank. That is a subject matter that we covered on RFA number 25 as well. We're going to leave off with a look at members of the Turple and Wilson team and their involvement with Nugenhan and some of the operations underlying the machinations of the secret team. We're going to proceed from that to Radio Free America number 30. We're going to resume with the Turple Wilson team, Brigade 2506, an organization called Karoo, and some of their terrorist depredations. But in a nutshell, that's what we're going to be dealing with this evening. And again, the programs will overlap with each other to a considerable extent, and the material will proceed very directly and very smoothly, hopefully, from information provided in our recently concluded Radio Free America series on the intelligence community and narcotics trafficking. And so that's basically what we have on tap.
All right. Without further ado, then, I suppose we have made all of our necessary announcements. And we can proceed to the meat of the broadcast, the information that we're going to be putting together for you tonight. We're going to start off with an article from Covert Action Information Bulletin, CAIB, Covert Action Information Bulletin. This is issue number 27, their special issue on the religious right. This is an article starting on the back page. It's one of their cover articles titled Disinformation Gate. The article is by Fred Landis. Fred Landis, among other things, co-writer of an excellent book, Death in Washington, that we recommend quite frequently on this broadcast.
And that we'll be using on RFA number 30.
Indeed. Okay, again, reading from Disinformation Gate, an article by Fred Landis. The North Ledeen Team. North, meaning, of course, Oliver North, and Michael Ledeen have worked together in a number of operations in recent years. Very different, but all, one way or another, involving PSYOPs, P-S-Y-O-P-S, or disinformation. PSYOPs, of course, is short for psychological operations. In 1983, North was involved in the Grenada invasion. And it skips down, he worked with Delta Force, which worked in the early hours of the invasion. The media were excluded, and U.S. Army PSYOPs took over the local press and radio. The mainstream U.S. media got a bizarre white paper authored by Michael Ledeen, purportedly based upon the 3 tons of documentation the U.S. invaders seized. That same year, Ledeen and North participated in a National Security Council planning group that led to the creation of the State Department's Office of Public Diplomacy. North fed the office CIA and DIA material on Nicaragua, grist for its propaganda mill, while Ledeen and others churned it out. In 1984, North masterminded an attempted drug trade sting against Nicaragua. North's colleague, quote, retired, unquote, General Richard V. Secord, purchased a C-123K cargo plane from Southern Air Transport. It was outfitted with hidden cameras and turned over to DEA agent Barry Adler Seal, otherwise sometimes known as Adler Barry Seal. The last name spelled like the animal, S-E-A-L. Seal then forced landed at a military airfield in Nicaragua, where he got photos of a Nicaraguan official, Federico Vaughn, investigating. That photo then became the basis of much disinformation on a supposed Jorge Castro narcotics trafficking ring. President Reagan used the photo on television, stating, with utterly no evidence or justification, that a box in the picture was filled with drugs. Like a bad penny, the same plane returned to Nicaragua in October 1986, carrying Eugene Hassenfuss. Now, this is interesting for a variety of reasons. One of the things we talked about in our introductory words tonight, of course, was the glass houses not throwing stones concept, also the pot calling the kettle black concept. There has been a massive disinformation campaign, which many of our listeners, because they're not the kind of people who perhaps read Reader's Digest all the time or, you know, listen to religious evangelists. Well, some of our readers, listeners do listen to the religious evangelists, but this has become a major key point in the anti-Sandinista propaganda is this supposed story of Sandinista / Castro drug peddling. And as we're going to see, the story not only originated within the Reagan administration, within the DEA, but there are some other mighty weird things attached to it.
Now, again, the Iran-Contra scandal first broke when Eugene Hassenfuss was shot down over Nicaragua in a C-123 that was being used to ferry arms and make airdrops to the Contras, operating in and near Nicaragua. As we're going to see, and as was indicated in the article Nip just read from Covert Action, that very plane, the C-123, was secured by Adler Barry Seal for the alleged Sandinista drug sting, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. As we're going to see, that's the very same plane that Eugene Hassenfuss was using in the Iran-Contra supply, in the Contra supply effort, I should say. And as we're going to look at, as we develop the Adler Barry Seal situation, much of the working capital in order to supply those arms came from cocaine smuggling. The very cocaine that was supposed to be being smuggled by the Sandinistas was in fact being smuggled by the Contras and elements allied with them. Research credit for the following story goes to Ted Rubenstein, an excellent researcher who's been working with us for some time. He got this from the Miami Herald. It's from the Herald of October 9th, 1986. It's by Jeff Lean, LWN, and Alfonso Chardi. It's headlined, Downed Craft Linked to Drugs. Subtitled, Two on Plane Had Ties to Miami Firm. Skipping down on the article, in the summer of 1984, Doan, that's a fellow who was operating was operating Doan Helicopter, which provided the plane to Southern Air Transport. In the summer of 1984, Doan swapped a C-123 to Adler Barry Seal, a Baton Rouge pilot and drug smuggler who became an undercover informant for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, according to Kent Sherman, a consultant on the deal who was a partner in Sherman Aircraft of West Palm Beach. Seal flew the plane to Rickenbacker Air Force Base in Ohio, where it was outfitted with hidden cameras by the CIA, according to a DEA agent who testified in court in Fort Lauderdale. Seal then piloted the aircraft to Nicaragua and returned with 1,472 pounds of cocaine. The cameras filmed Federico Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, who U.S. officials said was an employee of the Nicaraguan Interior Ministry helping load cocaine into the plane. As we're going to see, it is highly doubtful whether or not that cocaine really, in fact, came from the Sandinistas. As we're going to see, all of the people surrounding this alleged sting of the Sandinistas were, in fact, very closely tied to the Contras.
Just a short snippet of an article here to start off with. This is from an article entitled, Who Killed Barry Seal? By Joel Millman. And the article is originally published in the Village Voice for July 1, 1986.
Research credit for this also goes to Ted Rubenstein.
Again, a short segment from the article. Who killed Barry Seal? Federal officials were quick to point the finger at Colombian cocaine lords, against whom Seal was expected to testify later this year. But others may have wished to see Seal dead as well, including those behind the secret war against Nicaragua. In fact, evidence has emerged that Seal may have set up the so-called Sandinista cocaine smuggling operation himself, on orders from or with the cooperation of top administration officials. There are even those within the Soldier of Fortune community who believe that Seal had first-hand knowledge of drug smuggling operations involving the Contras. Now, one of the things, again, we talked about so interesting about this is Adler Barry Seal made what appears to have been a forced landing at a Sandinista base in Nicaragua. Adler Barry Seal then took photos, which his C-123 was specially designed to take. Again, remember the same plane that wound up being Eugene Hassenfuss's plane. And in that, in those pictures, he caught a Sandinista official of some sort by the name of Federico Vaughn. And then later on, there were allegations that Vaughn himself was involved and that there was a box of drugs he was handing over and all kinds of things. Well, not only is it doubtful, is there some reason to question whether, in fact, there was a box of drugs at all, et cetera, et cetera. But even Federico Vaughn is a rather interesting person.
Now, about the Adler Barry Seal operation, as we're going to see, while stinging the Medellin cartel, Seal came across information that the Medellin cartel, far from working with the Sandinistas, was in fact working with the Contras. Continuing now with a Village Voice article from July 1st of 1986. My brother was a detail man, says Ben Seal. Obviously, that's Adler Barry Seal's brother. He dealt in minutiae, not in broad concepts. While the war on drugs is certainly a broad concept, Seal's involvement with the DEA and the federal prosecutors entered a new phase with the ACOAs being one of the major families of the Medellin cartel. Barry Seal was doing something more than recording phone conversations or arranging the purchase of airplanes for drug smugglers or flying their drug receipts down to Panama for laundering. He was now embarking on a route that would bring him into the secret war against Nicaragua. The Ochoa cartel was in turmoil in the spring of 1984. Investigations into its smuggling activities were intensifying on both sides of the Caribbean. Early in the year, an important coca processing plant outside Medellin had been raided and destroyed by Colombian police. Medellin, by the way, is M-E-D-E-L-L-I-N. In April, the cartel was linked to the murder of Colombia's Minister of Justice. After years of dealing with impunity, top lieutenants of Flavio and Jorge Ochoa were fugitives from their own country, holed up in Panama trying to plea bargain an agreement with Colombian officials. Against this background, Seal continued to gather evidence against the cartel, meeting with Bates and Bustamante in the Bahamas and Panama, and together with Emil Camp, running small errands to earn the Ochoa's trust. Those gentlemen, by the way, were the people who were running Adler Barry Seal for the DEA. Continuing with the Voice article, he, Seal, agreed to fly a load of 1,500 kilograms of cocaine up from Colombia to Louisiana, the shipment that would be the basis of the U.S. case against the cartel. It was, in most respects, a normal exercise of baiting a trap and letting authorities know when to spring the snare until Seal brought in the Sandinistas. According to Seal's later Miami court testimony, he came upon the Sandinista connection by accident. He testified that when he first met with Jorge and Flavio Ochoa in Medellin, they told him they would soon be moving their processing facility to Managua, where, despite the fact that they themselves were staunch anti-communists, they said they had bribed top Sandinista ministers into allowing them access to military airfields. Later, Seal would revise his story to say that the Ochoas had also included Panama and possibly Costa Rica as locations for new facilities. Skipping down still further, according to Richard Grigori, the U.S. attorney who later put Seal on the stand in Miami, Seal flew the Ochoa's cocaine up from Colombia to the U.S. an average of twice a month for almost 2 years prior to becoming a federal informant. Yet despite months of difficult evidence gathering, the Ochoas may never come to trial. It is not clear how or where the breakdown in the case started, but within days of the fat lady's return from Managua, the Ochoa investigation began to unravel. With the alleged Sandinista connection, what had been a routine narcotic sting against the Ochoas suddenly took on political overtones, and separate federal agencies began to work at cross purposes. While federal prosecutor Grigori and the DEA were relying on Seal to bring back the goods on the Ochoa cartel, the CIA and the White House, which by then was taking a direct interest in Seal's flights, were more interested in the cartel's alleged Sandinista associates. The Ochoa case, in short, was top priority with the DEA, but the Sandinista connection was top priority with the CIA, while the Colombia case demanded secrecy, the Managua case demanded publicity. And as we're going to see, the allegation on the part of the Ochoa people that they were working with the Sandinistas begins to unravel rather quickly, and instead it becomes clear that, in fact, the Medellin cartel was working very, very closely with the Contras, and all of the people involved with this same sting were connected to the, much more closely connected to the Contras rather than to the Sandinistas, and in fact, there are direct connections between the Contra supply effort, people involved in that, and the assassination of Barry Seal, supposedly conducted by the Medellin cartel.
Skipping down in the same story, but closer examination of Seal's best-known exploit, the flying of Colombian cocaine into and out of Managua, may actually yield more damaging evidence against the White House and the Contras than against the Sandinistas. As skepticism grows over the administration's claim of a Sandinista connection to international dope trafficking, new charges are being raised that the Contras, not the Sandinistas, are involved with the cocaine trade. In the weeks leading up to Seal's murder, prominent congressional Democrats began pressing for hearings on alleged Contra abuses. U.S. Customs began an investigation into those charges, as well as into other charges that some of the Contras' quote, private supporters may have trafficked in illegal arms. Some reports have linked the Ochoas to Contra leaders in northern Costa Rica, which raises yet more questions about Seal's activities with the cartel. Quote, "What I still want to know," says John Camp, Seal's Baton Rouge TV biographer, "is just who was Federico Vaughn?" Vaughn disappeared in the summer of 1984 after his indictment in Miami. He is believed to be in Managua, possibly in the custody of the Sandinistas, who deny that Vaughn has ever been a, quote, top official or has worked for the government in any capacity since 1982. But if Federico Vaughn remains a mystery, his cousin's career is better known. Barney Vaughn is a banker in Miami, and he has ties to the Contras. Vaughn worked for Popular Bank of Hialeah until the end of last year, and now works for BAC International Credit Corporation of Miami and the Cayman Islands. Popular Bank is one of several Florida banks the General Accounting Office has identified as holding contra accounts. And, according to a report published by Robert Perry and Brian Barger of the Associated Press, BAC International is part of a CIA-run money laundering operation which has shuttled additional millions of taxpayer dollars to the Contras in violation of congressional restrictions. Vaughn, this is Barney Vaughn, who acknowledges his connections with top Contra leaders, says he has not seen his cousin since 1982 and denies any involvement with the Sandinista sting. Finally, there are questions about the men arrested for Seals' murder. Three suspects, all Hispanics, were seized within 12 hours of the hit. One, while running through New Orleans International Airport waving dollar bills and screaming about his urgent need to fly to Miami. Officials later indicated that the three men, all considered illegal aliens, had been traced from their entry near San Diego across the country to the Hilton Hotel several days before the murder. Four more men, one still not officially acknowledged as being linked to the Seal case, were picked up over the next 3 days. While each of the four is believed by law enforcement officials to have ties to the drug underworld, the mystery suspect has further links to both the Nicaraguan Contras and their sponsors among Miami's Cuban-American community. He is Jose Coutin, C-O-U-T-I-N, a suspected drug dealer and alleged member of the terrorist group Brigade 2506, now facing drug and gun charges in Miami. Coutin's gun shop has been a well-known meeting place for Contras over the last 2 years, and it is out of that store, police believe, that Coutin sold the Uzi used in the Seal murder. Coutin's connection to both a drug hit and the Contras raised the obvious question as to what other connections the two worlds may share. Who killed Barry Seal? While much of the evidence still points to a drug hit, in the end there were many people, Contras, drug lords, even White House officials, who might have suffered from his testimony and who have certainly profited from his demise. The stories Barry Seal might have told about the truth behind the Managua connection, about administration tactics against the Sandinistas and on behalf of the Contras, were buried with his body. A man praised as a star witness who knows how to hoard information and dispense it for his own advantage is a difficult man to trust. Quote, Barry was very smart, very manipulative, and he didn't always tell the same person everything he knew, says one of Seal's attorneys, Thomas Slafani. He may well have had contacts with the CIA that are greater and more intense than anyone knew about. He always had other irons in the fire. Why should Barry Seal be left open like this? Conventional wisdom says his killers were the ones against whom he was about to testify, the Colombians. But if Barry Seal was a loose cannon who possessed information that would be embarrassing to the government, politically, let's just say, hypothetically, he was the man who knew too much, unquote. Betrayed when his mission to Managua was leaked by the White House in 1984, and enjoying the freedom to testify openly under the terms of his 1985 plea bargain, would Barry Seal have fingered the White House in 1986? In the end, perhaps it was easier to risk his murder than to trust his silence. Quote, all the federal government had to do to kill Barry Seal, says Louis Unglesby, Seal's Baton Rouge attorney, was do nothing. Then let mischief work its will.
So basically, as we've seen, the cousin of Federico Vaughn was in fact a banker with connections apparently to the CIA as well as the Contras, and also apparently to some of the people involved in the Contra supply effort and who in turn were also implicated in the murder of Barry Adler Seal. We're going to take a look at more about some of the people involved there, namely Messrs. Coutin and Garcia. Research credit for the following story as well goes to Ted Rubenstein. This from Monday, August 4th, 1986, Miami Herald. It's headlined, Contra Supporter Tells of Tangled Scheme. This was a time when Miami teemed with intrigue and support from Nicaraguan rebels, for Nicaraguan rebels. Contra personages took to the Cuban airwaves here to raise money. Garcia, that's Jesus Garcia, recognized Posey. Posey is Tom Posey, head of Civilian Materiel Assistance, formerly Civilian Military Assistance, another person involved with the Contra supply effort. Garcia recognized Posey. He had seen him on ABC's Nightline. He was impressed. He was a famous freedom fighter, said Garcia. The two men hit it off well. Posey didn't stay in jail long. Joe Coutin, C-O-U-T-I-N, 41, a downtown Miami gun dealer, and Jack Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-L-L, 45, a self-taught soldier of fortune, showed up to post bond. When Posey left the jail, he took Garcia's unlisted telephone number. A few days later, Posey called me, said Garcia. We got together and he reintroduced me to Coutin, and I realized that I had tripped into an organization, unquote. Posey, Garcia said, spoke to him one day about a plot to assassinate Louis Tams, then the U.S. ambassador to Colombia. As Garcia tells it, Posey told him that Colombian drug dealers wanted Tams dead and were willing to pay $1 million for his murder. The two men talked about bombing the U.S. embassy in Costa Rica when Tams arrived there on a new assignment, Garcia said. The idea was to make everyone think the Sandinistas did it, Garcia said, and this would give the United States a wonderful opportunity to invade Nicaragua. At a cocktail lounge at a Howard Johnson's near the airport, Garcia said he talked to five other men about the plot a few days later. Among them, he said, was Bruce Jones, once the subject of a Life magazine article, a CIA man in Nicaragua. Garcia said he saw some boxes stashed in one of the motel rooms. He believed they contained C4 explosives for the embassy job. All this, accurate or inaccurate, came to naught. No one got blown up. I just got turned off, Garcia said. I didn't want to talk about hitting an American, unquote. Jones is said to live in Arizona, and the Herald couldn't reach him for comment. Posey said that he didn't know anything about the plot. He said he helps the Contras by sending advisors, clothing, and medical supplies. Never weapons and soldiers. Not long after the cocktail hour at Howard Johnson's, possibly in late February or early March 1985, Garcia said he provided Coutin, the Miami gun dealer, with a little assistance. He said he helped him load crates of M16 automatic rifles, mortar tubes, Soviet bloc-made AK-47 assault rifles, and several grenade launchers into a van. Garcia said he thought the weapons were destined for the Contras in Central America. They were supposed to be shipped out of the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, he said. Coutin denied all this. He is a founder of the Cuban Legion, a group of Cuban-born ex-GIs. The Legion shipped medicine, clothing, and food to the anti-Sandinistas, never guns, he said. Coutin's gun shop, the Broadway Boutique, used to be Miami headquarters for a Contra support outfit known as CMA. Posey is CMA's leader. CMA made headlines a couple of years ago. Two of its men were shot down in a helicopter over Nicaragua during a battle between rebels and government troops. In the summer of 1985, while fingerprinting the bad guys at jail, Garcia agreed to do a little favor for Coutin. He had a man going to Honduras and wondered if I could possibly get a machine gun with a silencer, said Garcia. Garcia obliged. He got the weapon, he said, from a man named Chino. It didn't happen that way at all, said Coutin. He said Garcia approached him and offered to sell him the weapon for his 11-piece machine gun collection. At any rate, Garcia still had the weapon when he received a phone call on August 8 from a stranger from Evansville, Indiana. The man identified himself as Alan Saum, S-A-U-M, and told him he wanted to see him about an important mission. He picked him up at the airport at 3 a.m. He came to me, talking about patriotism and blowing up the Russian embassy in Managua. He called this operation George Bush's baby, unquote. And more about Coutin's gun shop here in the murder of Atherberry Seal in another little article, this one by Sandra Dibble, the same woman who wrote the other larger article, a section of which I just read. This is called Murder Weapon Came from Miami. An Uzi machine gun used in the murder of ex-TWA pilot Barry Seal, a drug smuggler turned federal informant, came from the downtown Miami gun shop of Jose Coutin. Coutin, 41, loaned the weapon to Jose Maria Renteria Campo, one of six people accused in the assassination of Seal February 20th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Coutin testified before a grand jury in Louisiana. He told the Herald he lent Campo the weapon as a sample. He said Campo promised to buy a large order of guns legally. 8 days after Seal's murder, federal agents arrested Coutin on another weapons charge. So basically the major point here is that Coutin and Garcia, Coutin's gun shop being the shop that provides the weapon that gets rid of Barry Adler Seal, they're basically inextricable from the milieu, the network involved in the Contra supply effort. And we're going to take a look now at the fact that basically at a possible motive for the murder of Adler Barry Seal other than the The official explanation, which is simply that he was being eliminated by the Medellin cartel.
We're going to read from an article entitled Narco-Terrorism, A Tale of Two Stories. The article is by Joel Millman, and it appeared in the Columbia Journalism Review in 1986. Skipping down into the story, the first comprehensive report of the involvement of the Contras in drug smuggling appeared at the end of 1985, when the Associated Press ran a story based on the investigations of reporters Robert Perry, spelled P-A-R-R-Y, and Brian Barger. Perry, a career AP reporter, started covering events in Central America from the Washington Bureau in 1981. Barger, who resigned from the agency in August, came to the AP in early 1985 after covering Latin America for 9 years for the Washington Post, Pacific News Service, ABC News, and others. It was Barger who had discovered the CIA, quote, murder manual distributed to Contra forces in 1984. But it was only after Perry got onto the story and emphasized the manual's endorsement of assassinations that it became front-page news. In 1985, Perry won the George Polk Award for his reporting on Central America. In March 1985, Barger, who had written several stories about private U.S. groups that were helping to outfit and train Contra forces, began hearing that the rebel leaders were involved in drug smuggling. Skipping down. After contacting several law enforcement agents, many of whom confirmed the rumors, Perry and Barger asked their editors to send them to Central America to track down the story. Initially, citing the many AP reporters already posted in Central America, the editors refused. But finally a compromise was struck, and in early December the pair flew, not to Central America, but to Miami. In Miami, Contras and Contra supporters described a well-developed cocaine transshipment base in northern Costa Rica. After a flurry of phone calls to Washington, the two reporters were told that they could fly on to Costa Rica, where they soon learned that local officials had charged a Contra commander with cocaine trafficking, but had been unable to bring him to trial because he had fled to Panama. In addition, U.S. law enforcement officials in the region told the reporters that drug smuggling had become an established practice among the main Contra factions in Costa Rica. Let me read that again because that's important. This is the U.S.'s own law enforcement officials. Remember, we've talked about in the past that agencies like the DEA and the CIA are not monolithic, and that oftentimes the right hand is going after the left hand. And this is what we're talking about here. In addition, U.S. law enforcement officials in the region told the reporters that drug smuggling had become an established practice among the main Contra factions in Costa Rica. Other sources identified members of the Miami-based anti-Castro terrorist group Brigade 2506 as the chief link between Colombian cocaine lords, the Contras, and drug distributors in the U.S. Back in Washington, Perry and Barger began following up on leads and boiling down their notes into a 1,500-word story. It quickly became clear that their superiors at AP were uncomfortable. Skipping down after some descriptions of AP sitting on the story. As Christmas approached, Perry says, it looked more and more as if the wire service wasn't going to run the story. On December 16th, however, an editor working overnight at La Prensa Asociada, the AP's Spanish language wire, called up the Perry Barger story on his computer terminal and, without checking to see if it had been cleared for publication, translated the latest draft and sent it out over the wire. The next morning, the story appeared in Spanish language papers in New York, Miami, and throughout Latin America. Federal agents link Contras to drug smuggling, declared New York's El Diario La Prensa. Included in the story was a quote from a U.S. official linking, quote, virtually all Contra factions to drug smuggling, as well as a reference to John Hull, from whose farm drug shipments were allegedly flown. The story also included a denial from Hull, who said that the charges amounted to, quote, communist disinformation, unquote. 3 days later, on December 20th, the AP ran an English-language version of the story. Gone was the reference linking, quote, virtually all Contra factions to drug smuggling, as was any mention of Hull.
More details now about the Iran-Contra drug smuggling operation. Let's just say the involvement of drug smuggling in the Contra supply effort. We'll get to Iran presently, although obviously that's inextricable with the whole situation here. Reading now from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, January 19th of 1987. This is a story by Rod Nordland, N-O-R-D-L-A-N-D, of Newsweek. Its headline, Jailed Trio Link Contras to Drug Trade. Dateline, Miami. Three figures in cocaine smuggling cases have resurrected questions about possible drug trading by U.S.-backed rebels fighting to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. Two of them were interviewed in federal prison in Miami last week. One is a convicted drug smuggler, Gary Betzner, 45, a crop-dusting pilot from Arkansas. The other, George Morales, accused of being a smuggler, is a Colombian emigre with an aircraft chartering business who is a world champion speedboat racer. The government has charged him with running drugs as well. Facing the prospect of long jail terms, both men are trying to blame the Contra rebels, hoping to sell their story to prosecutors in exchange for immunity. The Contras didn't give a damn where the money came from, Morales said. Morales, who provided the planes, and Betzner, who flew them, both claim that CIA agents and other U.S. officials helped the Contras run the drugs out, guns in operation. I smuggled my share of illegal substance, Betzner said, but I also smuggled my share of weapons in exchange, with the full knowledge and assistance of both the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, and the CIA. Morales and Betzner said the Contras leaders justified the smuggling by their need to replace the military aid taken away by Congress in 1984, then cynically pocketed the proceeds. The Contras in the field were screwed, Morales said. They didn't have enough beans to eat. In Miami, the FBI has found a third witness who claims to have been seen Southern Air Transport planes being located with cocaine in Barranquilla, Colombia in 1985. The witness passed an FBI-administered lie detector test, then was given immunity from future prosecution for his involvement in the drug smuggling. Southern Air Transport is the firm implicated in Oliver North's network to supply arms to the Contras using funds from an Iranian arms deal. It also provided the plane in which American Eugene Hassenfuss was shot down by Nicaraguan government forces on a Contra supply run last year. Flight logs found on the plane show that other aircraft that had been used in the North network flew repeatedly to Barranquilla around the time that the federal witness claims to have seen the cocaine loaded. And, of course, bear in mind that that same plane was used by Barry Adler's heel, in his alleged Sandinista drug sting.